suspicions and what we could see of them at night time, and then came back and waited for our own troops to march down cross country in there and put them into position. We were in there by daylight, first light, but we just wondered what would have happened if Jerry had had a patrol out and gone through and found there was no one there. He could have come right through and wiped the Canadian Scottish out before anyone, without them knowing a thing. I don't know, I haven't seen anything in the history about that, but that was my one experience. I know that because I was there at the time. One of the amusing things happened at Puto, which I get quite a kick out of, was we had a little latrine for along the bushes there, and you went from your slip trench to the latrine. And there was one morning this lad was doing his morning there, when a shell burst close by, and it filled his backside with small pieces of shrapnel. I had a hard time convincing other people that they should use the latrine after that. He wasn't badly hurt, though. It was just a bit, small pieces of stuff in there. But it was amusing to see him, jump up and fly away from there with his pants down. And at La Rotte's, it was it was a good position. It was quite nice weather. We could lie on the grass. You weren't allowed to lie naked or anything because you showed up to the airplane, but you could lie on the grass in your battle dress, and things were quiet in the middle of the day. Look up, you'd see the white streaks of the airplanes overhead up high as they went either from back to England or from England to Germany bombing them. The machine gunners used to come in, set up in our position and blast at the enemy, and then they'd scuttle away, and then 5 minutes later we'd be heavily shelled by the enemy because there were no machine gunners around there at this time. We didn't like that at all. We used to protest them coming into our position just to quickly, set up their guns and fire for about 10 minutes on fixed lines at where the enemy was supposed to be, and then picking up and disappearing.
Didn't
get anything. All the shells would come down on us. We didn't. We had a few men wounded there, but most of them, they were dug in well. One lad, when he woke up one morning, found a shell in his slip trench from that door, from his slip trench, right in the ground like that. It just hadn't exploded. So he did a quick move out of that position. We were laying mines around that area. We had an unfortunate accident there where somehow either the mines had been primed, they'd primed them before they carried them into position, and I think that's what had happened, and that one fellow dropped the end of the box carrying him, because the whole thing went up and killed a lot of people, killed a lot of the soldiers, including one of my young lads who was in there helping them, or at least one who'd been in my platoon, because I was had two or three of a company.
Well, now that you mention it, I think Colonel Henderson mentioned that earlier.
Did he? Yeah, that's right. Yes, he had a hard time getting there because he had the Normandy glide, which is dysentery, and he was heading up there and he had to break off suddenly to go off, and I wondered what had happened to him. this young lad that was killed, he just got married before D-Day, before the troops were put in the concentration, and his wife had a baby afterwards, so he was a good lad, nice lad. From Rotts, as I said, we did a lot of patrolling out at night. Night patrols went out, but generally it was a fairly quiet position. There were a lot of shelling going around us. Carpiquet Airport was being bombed all the time as they tried to take that. And we did have one experience, I don't know, Larry told you about it, but one night we decided to play poker, the officers. There was an old farmhouse there, which I must say I went back to see in 1978, and it's still in the same place. Exactly, the ground is exactly the same as it was when I was there in 1943 or 44. But this barn, it's a barn and a house together, kind of, and we were living in the part of the barn of it. It was our company headquarters. So one night we decided to have a slight poker game. I don't play poker at all, really. I just play at it once in a while. I didn't know very much about the game. And I was so cleaned out of all my small amount of money I had, which were the francs that were given when we landed. And I borrowed some money from Larry. And from then on, I couldn't lose. from there, I cleaned out all the officers. I don't know. I think Larry probably mentioned that we captured, or the company captured a German paymaster on the way up from the beach.
No, I didn't.
Well, they captured a German paymaster who was on his way down to pay the troops. And they had these millions of francs, which was the same money as we were using.
Yeah.
So they divided it amongst all the troops and that. And because all these officers, I wasn't amongst those then because I hadn't landed with them. And so I took all this money away from them. And Larry says I had over $50,000.
Good Lord.
In francs for me. But I just had crap, just stacks over there. So I put it in the headquarters truck in a bag or in a box in there, because we were going into the attack in a couple of days' time. I just left it in the truck.
Well, they mentioned that. One thing he mentioned was about trying to crack a safe is what we were talking about. But unfortunately, all the money was no good.
Oh.
This is around the same area.
Was it? Oh, I didn't know that one. Mm-hmm. And but I'd found a portable gramophone in one of the mm-hmm. houses we'd gone to. Beautiful thing. And some records with it. And in the where the speaker comes out, I stuffed all this money in there. But that was where I put it in the truck. And about 2 days later, we went into the attack under Cussie,
mm-hmm.
and through Cussie into Caen. And I was wounded at that time, and so I came back out. But when I was in England, I wrote to Larry and I said, you know, if you look in my, pick up that gramophone of mine that I gave you, that or left in the truck, you'll find all the money in that. I wouldn't mind some of it coming back to me, because I was broke at this time. And so he wrote back and said, you've had it. He said the truck was hit by a shell. So we lost the whole thing, lost the company truck. But I've never forgotten that. And every time I see, well, every once in a while I see Larry, he always calls me the millionaire, because he's never forgotten how I cleaned them out. They didn't have a cent left when I did. And as I said, I'm not a poker player, but it was just that the cards came the right way, and I won everything.
Okay.
Well, then we moved one night at dusk from Puto, from Le Hamel Rotts area to make the attack on Caen. This would be around July the 6th, I think it was. And moved towards the Buron area, which is a cross-country march, and lined up to do the attack. And the attack was delayed many times. For why, we didn't know. We were just told it was delayed. And in the end, we did the attack. It was across fields. Oh yeah, we were shelled many times by these morning minis,
mm-hmm.
which were the five-barrel gun that shot off there. And we couldn't dig into the ground at all. It was so hard. We just had shovels, one or two. There might be one pick with about six shovels or so. And I've never seen such hard ground in all my life. I think it was an old road we were on, really, and trying to dig into that, because the wheat fields were close by. But the position we had to do was hard ground, so we just had to lie down and hope nothing had happened to us. And I don't think we got too many casualties moving into the attack. But when we went into the attack, they had everything going at us, the 88 guns, and you could hear the swish, swish, swish as stuff would go across the wheat. You didn't know whether it was going above you or in front of you or behind you, because you could hear the swish, swish, swish as the things would go on. And we were going into the attack when all of a sudden I found myself flying through the air, and I went down with a bang and got up again. I didn't feel any pain or anything. And next thing, I was flying through the air again. And when I got up, I found I had blood pouring down my face, and all down my battle dress. And I took another step forward, and away I went again.
Mm-hmm.
From another explosion, just three explosions quick like that. And then the stretcher bearer came along and said that, you know, I'd have to go back. I was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't see. I had no pain. Really, I had thump, you know, pounding like somebody punched you or so, but I didn't feel any pain at all. And then he lifted my steel helmet off my head, and blood just poured down my face. And so he put a bandage on me and told me to turn around and go back. And I managed to call out to Larry Henderson that I was wondering if I was going back. And he went on, but we lost a lot of our... I was with company headquarters, and we lost our signalers and runners and everything else, and that they were all, it was an 88 that had lined on us, and they were just fortunately far enough away just to get the explosion and the shrapnel from them. I had my chin skin all taken off my chin here, and I had a piece through my steel helmet, which right into my head. I still got my steel helmet somewhere. Yeah. I guess it's I've got it in the trunk with the hole in it and the camouflage net on it. I kept it as a souvenir, and then I had shrapnel all through my arms and legs. So that was the battle. As far as I was concerned, I was returned to England, spent a month in the hospital there, which I must admit were excellent. The stretcher bearers got me back to the first aid post in a jeep, when the advanced dressing station, I suppose it was, and the doctor gave me a shot of morphine or so. And then I was taken to near the beach, and we were just lying out in the field. There were hundreds of them, wounded people, Germans, British, everything, all lying there. I always remember some German calling away, and none of us could understand German, but it was a British officer who could, who was right next to us. So we said to him, did he understand? He said, yes. And he said he thinks we're going to kill him. That's what he's moaning. He doesn't want to be killed. He thought we were going to shoot him or so. And because one thing I do remember, when I did, when I was being evacuated, there was a wounded German on the field there, and they were going to take him, and I said, no, I said, you've got a lot of Canadians there, you've got to go first. I said, you can come back and get the German. But I knew there were other ones where I was wounded who were still there. Mm-hmm. And so I told the stretcher bearers to go back and get them rather than pick up the German. But it wasn't that I had anything against the German, but I thought the Canadians should get the first treatment. They were Canadian first aid men and should be looking after Canadians or their allies first. We were then taken from this, I don't know, I suppose it was probably an advanced dressing station or something like that, and where, as I say, seemed to be hundreds of people just lying out in this field all on stretchers, different stages of wound. And that night we were taken down onto the beach and put into big marquees, which it was a Canadian hospital then. And the nurses there were just wonderful to us. They came around all the time. I didn't sleep. I couldn't sleep at all then. I don't know why. I just couldn't. I was just wide awake the whole night long. We got shelled, or the airplanes came over and bombed the beach, but didn't do us. But those nurses never took cover at all. They just stayed there, looking after the wounded. There was nothing to stop. I mean, the shrapnel would come through that tent easy enough. And then the next morning, we were putting on a large landing craft truck, they had stretches all around the side of it. We all put nearly about four or five tiers high. Mm-hmm. And the doctors came along and said, how are you feeling? I said, fine. He said, well, you better take this pill in case you get seasick, because it was kind of rough crossing or something. I took the pill, I was immediately seasick. Prior to that, I didn't feel sick at all. And just following the pill, and I had that vomited right there. And we went across. It was a rough crossing, all right, but I think I slept most of the time. Got to Portsmouth or Southampton, I can't remember which it was, and put on a train, and taken up to Park Pruitt, which is, I can't remember now, but it's somewhere north near, west and north of London, I think. Mm-hmm. And there we were putting in ambulances and taken to the Park Pruitt Hospital, which is a specialist hospital for face wounds, you know, and skin grafts and things like that. And I remember going into the operating room somewhere around midnight. There were so many of us there, and they just operated around. And I got a shot, and I went to sleep, and then I suddenly remember waking up and pointing to my foot and telling the doctor that there's something in my foot that's bothering me, you should take that out first, or something like that. The next thing, I was pushed down forcibly and given another shot, put a mask on my face that time, and I was breathing ether in then. I guess the Pentothal that they'd given me hadn't worked as much as I thought, or maybe it was just I don't know what it was, but I always remember sitting up and hear these doctors rolling their white masks, and then I sat up and pointed to my foot, because I'd got something that was hurting my foot, a piece of shrapnel. And there I stayed for a while, and I was in there for about a week or 2 weeks, and I went to number 23 Canadian General Hospital. I know it was in close to an insane asylum. because we could hear these people yelling and shrieking at night time. It was a very big hospital. And there I stayed until while they did the rest of my wounds. And then I went to Colchester to the big convalescent place where you were brought back to good health.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a time there, I think about 2 weeks there or so. And then I was sent back to the reinforcement depot at Aldershot and was offered a promotion if I wanted to stay there. And I said no. And they said, well, we'll send you back to Canada. So I said, fine. They sent me back to Canada as a training officer to train at the A-37 Canadian Infantry Training Center at Petawawa to train soldiers for overseas. And I must admit, when I got back to Canada, I was very, very disillusioned with what was going on here, and I immediately asked to be transferred back to to Europe again. And I got a General Perks, was GOC out here then, and I got on to him, and he put me in for it. And I got a very nasty telegram from Ottawa saying McNeil will stay, will go where he's posted. So I continued on to Petawawa then, and did the training center there, and I had about 300 or 400 men training all the time in platoons to get them ready to go overseas as reinforcements. They were volunteers at first, and then I got the NRMA people in, the National Resources Manpower, or something, what they call the zombies.
Mm-hmm.
But I found most of them, those that I had to deal with, weren't too bad. They were certainly didn't like discipline, but if you had good NCOs, they certainly got down to liking it. We had a good. I used to throw a lot of company parties for them to keep them happy at night time, because Petawawa is a big camp, as you well know.
Middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and the nearest place was Pembroke, and that wasn't very much to them. But we sent a lot. Good reinforcements. At least I thought they were good reinforcements. Having been there, I knew I didn't want any of these people who hadn't even seen a mortar. Because I remember at Rotts, we got a group of men in, and they'd never even seen a 2-inch mortar, and they were supposed to be firing the 2. They were sent to us as mortarmen. We had to set up a class for them, instruction, right at La Rotts, and train them in the mortar and train them in the Bren gun as well. They just hadn't got any experience. So while they were at Petawawa, I made certain that they got experience in there. Brendant and the other officers I'd had had been wounded, some in Italy, and the lieutenants and that, so they were all enthusiastic about getting these men trained.
Must have been quite a time though, comparing notes.
Yes.
Between the two, and difference in Sicily and Italy. And
yes, there was, yeah. Yes, because we thought it was pretty grim, but when you read the history of the Italian campaign, I always regret that the wartime experience of the Canadians It's not part of the history of that's taught in the schools, because
mm-hmm.
those children would realize what their grandfathers and fathers went through, and the tremendous suffering that they went into, and moving up Italy. It was terrible. When the armistice came along, VE Day, I was still in Petawawa, and immediately asked to go back to the occupation army, but didn't get anywhere. I was, VE Day came along, and immediately went to the VJ, went to the Japanese force,
mm-hmm.
and was posted to, I couldn't get away right away, because I had to get all these people cleared out of the camp, and we had to stay there and see that they were either demobbed or went to some other places while I, and then the artillery came in for the Japanese do, and I had to train them in infantry tactics to a certain extent. Why, I don't know, but then when VJ Day came along, I asked to go back to the occupation force, and was said no. I was to go to Vernon Camp and train the Pacific infantry people, but they'd already been, there was no reason to train them, but anyways, I arrived in Vernon Camp and was told the camp had closed down. I was to go to Vancouver. So I headed to Vancouver, and there was no work for us there. They didn't know what to do with it. There was quite a number of officers there. So we then sent to the engineer training center at Chilliwack, and there we went into the woods and with a Wee MacGregor saw, which is a great thing, you know, carried by four men, put on cedar logs and cut them up and made shakes for the scout hall that they were building. And that's how we had majors, captains, lieutenants, pilot officers and everything else doing all cutting out shakes.
Is that up the Chilliwack? Chilliwack Lake?
Yeah, Cultus Lake.
Oh yeah.
Cultus Lake, yeah. So we spent 2 or 3 weeks doing that, and then I was called down to Vancouver and told I was the claimed an investigating officer for the area, which meant that any accident involving a D&D vehicle I had to investigate and decide who was to blame and who was to pay for it and things like that. And all property damages done by the troops in British Columbia had to be settled. And so I had quite a time traveling by Jeep all over the interior of BC, particularly around the Vernon areas, trying to settle the various damage claims that came in. And in Vancouver we were busy because we had a lot of vehicle accidents. Some were by people who just whipped the car, a truck out from the things and crashed it, and others were by men on duty who had various things that happened. So they all had to be investigated. And then I guess that went on until just about the beginning of October when I was posted to October 46. So I was posted to PPCLI in Calgary on the formation of the regular army.
Did you ask to stay in the regular force? Or?
Yes. So I did this at Petawawa. They came down and said, "Did you want to stay in the reserve in the regular force?" And I applied then, and I was accepted, which I was very fortunate.
You kept your same rank.
I kept my same rank. Yeah, which was major then. I kept that, and went to PPCLI and became a company commander with no men. As they didn't have any, not enough soldiers in. But I then, with one of the other majors, Ronnie Waterman, conducted an NCO school for training soldiers to be NCOs. And we did that until the end of October, when I suddenly was told I was going to Alaska as the Canadian Army Observer with Task Force Frigid. And as much as I fought at this, because I'd applied for staff college, and I'd been accepted to write the exams and the pre-staff study, and then here I was being posted off to Alaska. So they did everything they could to stop it, but it didn't work. I went and took off to Seattle, and then went to the big field, McCord Field, took what was then a very large four-engine plane up to Alaska and flew there for 12 hours, I think, to get there, and arrived in Anchorage, and then put on another plane taken to Fairbanks. Arrived at Fairbanks at about 30 below zero, with just an army greatcoat on, you know, and everything. And because the Canadian Army had more Arctic equipment, if they did, they certainly weren't going to give any to me to go up there. And I joined that task force, and I spent 6 months with them, and it was most interesting. I learned a tremendous amount about the Arctic conditions and the equipment. We had temperatures of minus 72 below zero, and we were out in the field, and on the night it was 72 below zero, living in an ordinary tent, but we had good sleeping bags, and we had coal stove in the tent. But no, there'd be days when not a vehicle would run because it was so cold, it would take them most of the day trying to get them to run. And of course, as you chop a wood and your axe would break because it was so cold. And tried to cross, well, we built some bridges across the rivers, which was no problem, by just laying logs on top of each other, spraying them with water, and the water froze as it sprayed on there. You had to keep on throwing your pumps out, really. We had every bit of equipment the American Army had, I think, from the huge tank transporters to tanks, all their large guns and that, and tested them all.
Did they later ask you to give certain points? I know later on Canada was working on toward getting an Arctic going as a major sort of an Arctic.
Yes. Well, when I came back from Alaska in April, I went to Ottawa and had to write a report on all the equipment. And the Americans were very good. I had a complete set of all their Arctic equipment when I came down. And Ottawa didn't seem to be too interested in that. So I gave it to the Regimental Museum at Kerry Barracks. I wrote this report. I had pictures of everything. Every bit of equipment they tested and when all it was being tested, all the stuff that broke and that, we had pictures. They had a wonderful sort of photography team up there, and they were very good. They gave me, I think, 2 copies or 3 copies of everything. So we include this in our report. There was one other officer up there, a chap by the name of King Clay, who was signal captain, and he was looking after mainly after the signal equipment. And I did most of the infantry. I looked after infantry, but I was also interested in all the guns and the tanks and things like that. So we both, you know, shared the stuff, but he wrote the from the signal point of view, and I wrote from the infantry point of view.
Do you ever, I know later on, I can't remember the exact date, Air Marshal Dunlap told me about Operation Muskox.
Yes.
Did that, would you think of that would have had any bearing on what you would have done, or they would use some of your information?
Well, Muskox took place just before this American, yes, because the colonel who was commander of Muskox was flown up by the Americans to Alaska to talk to the American officers on the cold weather operations. But there again, because Muskox was mainly an oversnow, at least an Arctic expedition, but they had one type of vehicle only, which was the Penguin oversnow vehicle. We also had Sir Hubert Wilkins up there from Australia to tell the Americans how to you know what to expect. And Dr. Paul Seipel is another great American who worked out this Winchell factory. He was there because they were both Wilkins and Seipel were more Antarctic than they were Arctic, although Wilkins had spent some time in the Arctic. And while I was in Fairbanks, I went on every test that they did out in the field with them for the 3 or 4 days when they had the infantry. They had airborne troops. They dropped them. I wasn't a jumper, so I couldn't jump with them. But we went and watched all this sort of stuff. And then up in Point Barrow, which is the northern tip of the continent, the U.S. Navy, their Seabees Construction Battalion, were up there drilling for oil. And so I went up there between Christmas and New Year's and spent the time with them and saw all their problems. Mm-hmm. And the tractor trains going across the northern barrens there, taking supplies into them. Taking out to the various oil plants. They were drilling for oil in those days, and they had oil up there in Point Barrow in 1946 or something. Yeah, 46, 47. And because the thing, as I said, they didn't have to worry about the water in the oil because they just put it in barrels and the oil and the water froze and the oil stayed on top. And they just poured off the oil and they had pure oil. But that was very interesting, and they did a lot of testing on between Arctic between white man and Eskimo in Arctic clothing, put them dressed exactly the same, put all these test things all over their body, and had them sitting outside in the cold. And it was most interesting there. They did a lot of that.
I think now Canada's really more advanced than Arctic.
Yes.
Because of it.
Yes. After we left, I wrote this report in Ottawa. I came back to the battalion again at Calgary and did training with them for, I think it took us 2 months to write that report. It was a tremendous report because we had so much to do. I then spent time with the battalion, went on exercises at Wainwright, and came back from them. And again in October, I was told I was to go to Churchill as the chief instructor in Arctic.
You're right, you can't get away.
And there again, I just applied for staff college and accepted again to write because I had to give the other one up because when I got up to Fairbanks, I got a letter from them from Western Command saying return all the staff college study material because you will not be able to write staff college exams up there. So I had to return all that to them. And then I got here and was sent to Churchill and I arrived there. Well, I sent to Winnipeg to learn about Churchill and went up on court martials and things like that. And early in January of 48, I took over from Brian O'Connell, who was the first chief instructor up there. And when I became chief instructor in OC Training Wing, until April 39. And we did exercise across the Arctic. Well, we trained the men in how to live and survive in the Arctic. That was our main object,
mm-hmm.
To survive, live and survive in the Arctic. We also trained U.S. Canadian Navy and Canadian Air Force fellows, because the Air Force have a different system of survival than we do, because if they're down, they have an airplane with them,
mm-hmm.
and they can live, they stay close to their airplane, and they have the gasoline from the plane, usually, too, which to keep themselves warm, and they have their survival stuff on the plane. Or in our case, we were trying to teach soldiers who were moving and fighting across the North how to keep warm if they were separated,
mm-hmm.
or if away from their troops, or if they were forced to stay in one position for any length of time, to dig snow caves,
mm-hmm.
to build igloos, and things like that, and how to maintain their equipment, and how to keep warm. That was our whole
mm-hmm.
task. And then also navigation. How to find a way, how to move in the north, because your compasses can go out because you're so close to it, so you had to go by stars. I took an astro navigation course as well with the Air Force when I was there.
Did they have the Arctic tents that they have nowadays?
Yes, we had the Arctic tents then.
Still, they haven't changed much at all.
No, I don't think they have. I haven't seen them recently. We had some excellent Arctic sleeping bags,
mm-hmm.
and we had some terrible ones. However, they changed every year, because they'd get a group of men up and say, what do you think of this bag? And they say, well, this is the best one, you know. And then the next year, somebody else came along and said, the other one was the best. I don't know, the Arctic bag that they accepted was the one that we had in Korea, which was a death-dealing bag, as far as I was concerned. You could never get out of it fast enough. The one that we accepted had at one time had two zippers. It was a double bag and had zippers, but you just did like that and the zipper came right apart.
Well,
quick release, which is, you know, in case you have to get out, in case of a fire or anything like that. These others were the mummy type bags, which only had a very small opening.
Short zipper down,
And you couldn't get out of it.
That's the type I remember using. They were warm, but
they were warm.
I always wondered how the hell you'd get out of there if you had a
fire.
Well,
we found out that you couldn't, because we were using those in Korea, and my tent caught on fire when we were back in the light, and I couldn't get out of my sleeping bag. I managed to get out of the tent because I just jumped jumped out in my sleeping bag, but I couldn't get out fast enough, because when the tent went up, it went out quickly. And a lot of the men in their bunkers, when their bunkers caught fire, were burnt to death because they couldn't get out of their bags.
Was this because of the space heaters they were using, those little...
Well, that was, some of it was caused by the explosion of them, but if they could have had a sleeping bag which they had a quick release on,
mm-hmm.
they would have been able to get out.
This is a constant danger. I remember being drilled into us to always have a man awake in your tent to look after and make sure the fire and the lantern didn't catch on fire. After you'd been on guard duty and been up for numerous hours, if one person alone, you'd constantly find him falling asleep.
Well, because in our case, we wouldn't allow any lights or heat on in the
mm-hmm.
tents at night. Once the man went to sleep, the last man... Well, it was usually the tent commander would have to turn them out at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you woke in the morning, the first man awake would light the tent, but usually the first man awake never moved. He waited for somebody else because it was too damn cold.
Kept his eye open
while
he's first man awake.
Would you like to stop for a minute?
Certainly could, yeah.
That's just 12 minutes.